committee will come to order. Please note Representative Spano has an excuse absence for today's meeting. And Kaylee Wright, will you please call the roll?
Chair Beleka.
Here.
Vice Chair Moritas.
Here.
Ranking Democratic Member Ray Winkle Vasalinda. Representatives Ahern.
Here.
Bracey.
Here.
Diaz.
Here.
Jones.
Here.
McGee.
Here.
Metz.
Here.
Pasadoma.
Here.
Saunders. Spano. Stone.
Here.
Thank you. Let the record show a quorum is present. Okay, members, committee members, today we go back to workshopping. Was too much energy for a bill last week, so we're going to need to take a break. But next week, get ready. We're going to have two or three bills. We should have two or three bills up. What we're going to go through today is a workshop. We're going to hear from Jane Fletcher, and she's the director of the Division of Accountability at the Florida Department of Education. She's going to workshop this in the sense she's going to explain overall what we're trying to accomplish in our accountability system. She's going to give us an overview of the accountability system, and then there is draft language for a bill that probably will be up next week. So it's a great opportunity to ask questions, to have some dialogue, and the draft language of the bill is contained in this packet, so we can go into next week fully up to speed on the legislation. So, Ms. Fletcher, will you please come on?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, this afternoon I'm going to talk with you a little bit, as the chair mentioned, about Florida's accountability systems for schools. And for small schools in particular, since that's some of what your bill focuses on. Florida's school grading system has several purposes that you all are, I'm sure, aware of, and one is to make it real clear what school performance is to the public. And it uses a universally understood metric, the A through F grading system, that people are familiar with, so that when they hear about an A school, they have a feeling about what that means. This performance on the school grading system is based on student outcomes. How well are students doing on various performance metrics within that school? And accompanying that school grading system is a system of rewards and supports. Schools that get an A grade or increase their grade are eligible for school recognition dollars, and schools that get an F grade or a D grade get supports and interventions through the differentiated accountability process. The primary and long-lasting goal of the school grading system and the school accountability system is to raise student achievement and success and to bring more opportunities to students and open the doors for them as they move forward. I'm going to walk you through sort of the basic model of the school grading system, sort of what's in the model, what are schools graded on, and how does it work. You see that there's four different areas: reading, math, writing, and science. And those are the basic areas that students within Florida have assessments. Each of those areas is worth 100 points in the school grades model, and that's 50% of the basic model is based on student performance. Did a student score satisfactorily above? So, for example, if a school in reading has 75% of its students scoring satisfactory or above, then they get 75 points for that cell of the formula. The bottom two rows are based on learning gains. So the first row is performance, and the bottom two rows are based on learning gains. And this looks at what a student scored last year and compares it to what they scored this year. And if they made a gain, then they get a point in this system. So if 75% of the students made a gain over last year, then they would get 75 points in that learning gains. Florida's model also focuses on the lowest performing students and provides schools an incentive to work with those students and to help them increase. And that's what the low 25% gains is. In that area, if when we look at the students who are scoring at the lowest 25% in their school and whether those students made gains, did they move towards satisfactory performance? And so the learning gains is 50% of the basic model, and performance is the other 50% of the basic model. For elementary schools, they get graded on the basic model, and that's it. For middle schools, there's one additional component, and that's acceleration, and that's an additional 100 points. And they get points based on students' participation in high school courses with EOCs and performance in those courses. And that's kind of similar to some of the additional components that are in the high school model. This next slide shows the high school model. And the gray part on the left-hand side, that's essentially just the basic model. So high schools are graded on the basic model, plus they have some additional components. They have acceleration components. That's how did they do in dual enrollment, advanced placement, IB, ACE courses. Also, the graduation rate is in the other side of the formula for high schools, and also college readiness. Are students getting ready for college while they're in high school? So those are sort of the basic components of the school grades model. And in this high school model, 50% are in that basic model, or the assessment components, and 50% of the grade is based on those other components. Now, there's some schools that don't get a school grade. They get a school improvement rating. This is mainly for alternative schools. These are schools that serve a different population of students and is mostly for at-risk students who are having difficulty and for some reason need to be served in an alternative school. Now, these schools have the ability to choose whether they're going to be receiving a school grade or whether they're going to receive a school improvement rating. So the schools get to choose. If the school chooses a school improvement rating, which is based only on learning gains rather than performance and learning gains, what you saw for the school grade, this is only based on learning gains. If they choose the school improvement rating, then the scores of their students are not only included in that school improvement rating for that school, but they also go back to the home school of those students. These students came from somewhere else. The alternative school, the school improvement rating is based, as I said, on learning gains, and this calculation compares the learning gains of the students in the current year to those same students in the prior year and looks at whether they had more learning gains this year than they had last year. So in order to make this calculation, we need 3 years of student information, this year and last year, and then last year and the year before that. And that's going to become important later. In addition, for this calculation, there needs to be 10 kids in reading and 10 kids in math with 3 years of those test scores. And the alternative school needs to have tested at least 90% of the eligible students in order to receive a rating. And some of what's in the bill relates to some of these provisions, which is why I'm talking about them a little. And these are the three different ratings an alternative school can get. They can get improving, maintaining, or declining. To get an improving rating, the learning gains in the current year need to be at least 5% more than the learning gains in the prior year. Now, we've talked about the school grade and the school improvement rating, and on the surface you might expect, well, everybody's covered. But there are some schools that are not covered, that don't get either a grade or a rating. And there's some different reasons for that. When you see here, there were 3,339 schools that could have gotten a grade and 284 schools that could have gotten a rating. If you move down those columns, you see that there were 17 schools that got an I grade and 33 schools that got an I rating. Those are because they didn't test enough students. In our current models, we require a school to test at least 90% of the students in order to get a rating. And that is to make sure that schools have an incentive to assess all their students and to not cherry-pick which students they're going to assess, and to ensure that this grade is representative of the students at the school, that it represents all of the students that go to that school. So you see in the graded column that there were 233 schools that didn't receive a grade, and there are 159 schools who didn't receive a rating. That was 7% of the graded schools, but it was 56% of the rated schools. So there's a lot of schools that don't get a rating. When you look at that a little bit in more depth to figure out why some of those schools aren't getting a rating or a grade, when you look at the graded schools for the current year, there were 188 schools who had too few students with current year assessment scores, and then there were additional 45 schools who didn't have enough students with prior year assessment scores. And then in the unrated, in the rating category, there were 159 schools who didn't have 3 years of records. So it's in some ways it's more difficult because you have to have a child with 3 years of test scores in order to get the rating. And some of the alternative schools, some of these kids move around a lot. So this gives you an idea of what kinds of schools we're talking about here. When you look at traditional elementary schools, the top left cell, only 1% of traditional elementary schools are not graded. That's 22 statewide. When you look at combination schools, though, there are 96 traditional combination schools that are not graded, or 35% of traditional combination schools. So you can see it varies across the different kinds of schools. And when you look at ratings, you see that it's much smaller numbers but higher percentages of schools who would normally get a rating but aren't getting a rating because they don't have enough kids or they don't meet the percent tested requirement. And when I say enough kids, that's enough kids with test scores. And next I'm going to move on to exceptional student education centers. You may have heard about this issue. This is the very first year that exceptional student education centers were included in the school accountability system. And the inclusion of these centers is the result of the federal ESEA waiver that you may also have heard about. Florida pursued the federal ESEA waiver in order that we would only have to have one school accountability system. Before this, we had two separate school accountability systems that were telling us two different things. They were conflicting. And so with having only one system, we get rid of that conflict. However, the ESEA waiver requires that all students in the accountability system, whether they have a disability or not, be treated the same in the state's school accountability system. So in order to use our state system for, in place of, the federal system, we had to meet these federal requirements. Prior to the waiver, Florida's accountability systems included students with disabilities in the learning gains calculation, but not in the student performance calculation. So in the school grades basic model that I showed you, that row across the top that was performance, students with disabilities were not included in that row. They were included in those four blocks at the bottom on learning gains, but not in the performance part. And so because of that, because they didn't have any performance points, the ESE centers never received a grade before. When you look at ESE centers, the nature of their students that they serve are generally the students with the most severe disabilities. Even when you consider that many of those students may be taking the alternate assessment, they're likely to have large percentages of students scoring at emergent levels, which is below the satisfactory cutoff for the school grade system. Since performance accounts for 50% of that basic model in the points in the school grades calculation, center schools are likely to have low grades. Because of this, the department identified the school improvement rating as an accountability system that's already in place, that was already allowed through law, that might better serve the ESE Center schools, as it's based solely on learning gain. Learning gains is where those kids were already included. The school improvement rating system, however, was designed for alternative schools, but the definition of alternative schools in the law was broad enough to include ESE Center schools. So once we did that, then ESE Center schools had a choice to make. They could choose, just like an alternative school could choose, whether to receive a school improvement rating based on their learning gains or whether they wanted to receive a school grade based on both their students' performance and their learning gains. If they chose the school improvement rating, then the statute requires that the performance and learning gains of their students are also counted in the school grade of the student's home school, just like that would happen for an alternative school. This provision for alternative schools was designed to ensure that students were not sent to alternative schools to remove them from their school's grade. You wouldn't want a school to be taking kids out of their school grade and moving them to another grade school just because they weren't performing well. However, some of the students at ESE centers have never attended a home school other than the ESE center. And because of that, some ESE centers chose to receive a school grade rather than a school rating, even though they knew the performance of their students would be counted in the school grade. So what did they choose? When you look at the 99 ESE centers across the state, 27 of them chose to receive a school grade. 68 chose to receive a performance and improvement rating. So the bulk of them chose school improvement ratings, but there were some that chose to receive a school grade. When you look at the 27 that chose a school grade, only 11 of them actually received a grade because 16 had too few students. They had the small schools issue. And of those 11 that received a grade, one received a D and 10 received an F, essentially based on that performance issue that we talked about. When we looked at the 72 ESE centers that chose a school improvement rating, you see a different picture. There were about 40% of them that received an improving rating, 6% received a maintaining rating, and 54% received a declining rating. Then there were some that didn't test enough. They didn't meet the 90% tested criteria, and 16 that had too few students. And that is the end of the presentation.
Thank you so much, Ms. Fletcher. That was our accountability system in a 10-minute overview. So what I thought we would do, and if you can stay there, Ms. Fletcher, is have Jason, our policy chief on our committee, give us an overview of what's in the draft language, and it coincides with what we just heard, and I think that should help generate some questions, because there's some specific areas of what was just presented that we're going in, that this bill will go in and look to address.
Thank you, Chair. One of the pillars of our education accountability system is the robust amount of data that we have to enable stakeholders to make informed decisions. So part of the bill increases the access to this data for students, parents, the public, and school districts. And the other part of another provision in the bill creates a research engine to allow authorized representatives access to more detailed information to research how the reforms that we're making impacts student achievement. The rest of the bill deals with some of the issues that you heard today from Ms. Fletcher. It requires the department to define an ESE center school, provides how those students' performance is attributed to the home school that they attended, and it provides greater information to parents of students at all alternative schools. As you heard, most of those schools do not receive ratings, so the parents do not know how well that school is performing. So they will get a more detailed report of how their students are performing at that school. It also requires the department to issue criteria on issuing and revoking master school identification numbers.
Thank you so much, Jason. With that, we're going to open up for questions. I just stare at you now, Representative Saunders. I don't even look at anybody else. I hit that field of vision first question.
Eye contact. Actually, it was just a question for you, Jason. I missed that fifth part. What was the last thing you said?
It's the master school identification number. One of the purposes of that number is to assign accountability to schools. It's also used for other purposes, which is described in the bill, but it provides authority for the department to issue those numbers and to revoke those numbers if they were erroneously issued.
Representative Diaz?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jason, one more question on the ESC, alternative centers. The current law is that the school of the student goes back to their home school. What happens currently when a student has never attended a traditional or a home school and has always been in an ESC alternative center currently?
Because of the constraints of the current law, the students, I think it's learning gains, go back to the home school instead of their performance and learning gains. But in the bill, we try to address that by saying the student performance only goes back if the student, well, it doesn't go back if the student was not at a public school in the previous 3 years.
Ms. Fletcher, you want to comment?
Yeah, I think part of your question was also, what are we doing now if this child was never at another school, if they've always been at this center school? And what we did is we asked the district to, in order to comply with the law, we had to identify a home school. So the districts identified for us the school to which they would otherwise be attending if they were not at the center school.
Members? Ranking Member?
Thank you, Chair. What is the overall intent of the bill? In other words, what problem are we trying to fix with this?
We're trying to increase accountability by identifying, by holding more schools accountable. And it does that because currently, if the school does not meet a minimum sample size, which is 30, then they do not receive a school grade. So the bill would require that if you have 10 or more students, which you have student performance data for, then the school would receive a school grade or a rating.
And Chair, I have a question for you. We're not voting on this bill today, right?
Just you.
Okay.
We just now have one person left. Now, this is coming up. We want to give ample time, so this is coming up for next week. Should be coming up next week. The very near future. Yes, Representative Ahern.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is, how do we come up with the 5% as the determinator for the school improvement rating?
Ms. Fletcher, you are called to duty.
Sure. That's in state board rule. So the state board adopted that, and what they were looking to do was to the law provides that there are three different categories, and so the state board was looking at some band that made sense in terms of the maintaining is around zero or up or down 5%, and then above that is improving, and below that is declining. But the state board made that determination.
Representative McGee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is, if this bill were to pass, would this apply to public, private, and or hybrid and charter?
Go ahead, Ms. Fletcher.
This would apply to public schools and it would apply to public charter schools.
Okay, we are going to have okay, you have the mic.
Thank you. Representative McGee brought up a good question. Why are we not looking at perhaps grading private schools or anything or any other schools besides the public and public charters?
Ms. Fletcher, if you want to take a shot at that, feel free. We'll let you handle that one.
Well, I guess that in order to grade them, you would have to have some mechanism to, like, it would have to be a school you were funding, I would think. But I'll leave that up to you.
Can I ask a follow-up?
Sure.
Well, with vouchers, I mean, not in some ways, isn't there a nexus there that we could perhaps grade schools where vouchers are being received?
Do you want to speak to that? Well, I know with the Opportunity Scholarship, the bill last year, it was given, it created the option for the children on the opportunity, on the corporate tax scholarship to take, participate in the FCAT, and the districts would make it available for them, but it was not a requirement. Representative McGee.
As it relates to the ESC centers, correct me if I'm wrong, because I'm trying to get understanding of this. So we have these kids who've been determined to have an IEP, and based upon their IEPs, we make a determination on what particular class they fit within this ESC system. Once that system is determined, we then give the schools the opportunity to determine whether or not they want to participate in either the percentage or in the improvement. Realistically speaking, are we setting these schools up for failure in a sense that we're not having a sense of equality across the board, because we're forcing the schools now to make a determination on whether to exclude and hide under the umbrella of improvement, as opposed to giving the percentage and receiving the grade that will help their funding in the road? Are we setting these schools up for failure based upon this particular model?
Ms. Fletcher?
I don't think so. I think when you look at the ESE Center schools, if they get an improving rating, they can also get school improvement money. And these schools, some of the students that they're serving are really severely disabled. And even on the Florida alternate assessment, you wouldn't expect them in any short period of time, if ever, to get to the point where they would be earning them points on the system. And so it seems that an accountability system that focuses on the improvement of those students over time is the type of accountability system that may be the most reliable for that school.
Well, thank you very much. We do have a request for public testimony, and we'll call Sylvia Smith. She's a Director of Legislative and Public Affairs representing the Disability Rights Foundation. Sylvia, if you want to come up.
Good afternoon. Welcome to our rainy town. Thank you very much for workshopping this bill, and I wanted to first introduce myself. I'm an attorney at Disability Rights Florida, and I'm the Director of Legislative and Public Affairs. And it's normally my practice to speak to the chairman and to the committee staff before speaking to the committee, so I did want to apologize for that. But these workshops create a challenge, as you know, when you get language first thing in the morning. So excuse me for just kind of being here on the fly with you. I really look forward to working with you throughout the balance of the process on this bill. We are thrilled that you're talking about ESE Center schools. Sometimes we feel isolated that we're the only ones that think about ESE Center schools, because at Disability Rights Florida, what we do is we provide free, confidential legal assistance to families. And we're who families call when things aren't going right. So, unfortunately, what I have to talk to you about is sort of the tip of the iceberg of the families who contact us with real problems with IEP decisions, placement decisions, and what have you. We've been in existence since 1977, so we have accumulated a body of experience dealing with not only families, but how policies sometimes work out on the ground. And one of the things that's really challenging with center schools in the context of the work you're doing, which is very important, is the nuance of what incentivizes placement into a center school and what incentivizes inclusion. I don't have the answer to that question, but I encourage us all to think about it. And while we're thinking about it, I want to tell you about Matthew. Matthew was attending a center school and was assumed to be incapable of learning by even his mother because he could not express himself. He was tested, not by the school, but by his mother. His mother took the initiative to seek advanced testing, and it was determined that he was actually learning almost everything he was exposed to, but he did not have the capacity to express himself with speech. His mother, not the center school that he attended, obtained the assistive technology that allowed him to speak. And then, unfortunately, our agency had to spend 2 years seeking a corrective action plan from the Department of Education, which they issued because they agreed that the center school had denied his rights to free appropriate education. And then, unfortunately, in litigation to enforce that corrective action plan, we worked for 2 years with his family to secure his rights to have the assistive technology used at school so that he could learn and express himself. And I encourage you to visit our website or our YouTube channel and see him using his assistive technology device now to communicate about anything and everything. He has an opinion about many things. He's very he takes in a tremendous amount of content. He's the kind of child that we worry about when assumptions are made about who attends a center school and why. So we just get troubled whenever we're talking about why students are placed there and for how long and whether it was a lifetime placement. The argument around never attended a home zone school is not very compelling for us. We sort of like the idea of every home zone school owning every child in an ESE center school because it creates a recognition that every single year the IDEA, the federal special ed law, requires that we redetermine what the placement should be, what's the least restrictive environment for that child. So the connection to the home zone school says, you know, could he go? Could she go? How's he doing? Where are we at? Rather than sort of getting stuck, perhaps by accident, into this lifetime placement decision. So this three-year thing, I have a feeling it has nothing to do with incentives or disincentives. It has to do with what the way that the grade's calculated based on 3 years of performance, the improvement. But the first thing we thought of was, could encourage school districts to place kids early, because the quicker they got 3 years, the quicker they have 3 years of history of placement, the less they have to worry about counting the achievement of that student. Maybe we're a little worried. And that goes hand in hand with the kind of casework we do. We don't get to hear the good stuff. We only hear about the problem. So, but our accumulated experience has resulted in us being asked to serve on local, state, and national policy panels over the years, including the 2002 Blue Ribbon Task Force on Accommodations and Access for Students with Disabilities that was chartered by Governor Bush, and the 2012 Task Force on Inclusion and Accountability that was chartered by the former commissioner. And one of those recommendations that came out of the 2012 Task Force was really applauded by advocates and family members because it looked for ways to incentivize a connection to the home zone school. And we just encourage you to think about that as you go forward, and we will certainly be eager to meet with you personally and try to problem solve ways that your bill could accomplish the goals and objectives that you have, but also keeping in mind those task force recommendations around inclusion being the ultimate goal for every child for whom there's a possibility of returning to the home zone school or to some combination of separate school and home zone school, because we keep meeting children who can achieve more when they're spending more time with their non-disabled peers, and we keep encountering situations where the assumption that every faculty member at the center school is fully prepared to meet the needs of the students they serve doesn't bear fruit in reality, unfortunately. Thank you for your listening.
Thank you so much, Ms. Smith. And I think when you, Representative Diaz, Ms. Smith, I don't think you're leaving so fast. Representative Diaz has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it may be Ms. Smith or maybe Jason can answer this. Do we know how many students will be affected by these exemptions if they were put into place? Do we have any kind of idea how many kids are affected?
Well, I think Jane may be able to answer this more, but currently there are 99 ESC center schools, and what the bill would require would require DOE to define ESC center schools, so it would depend on how DOE defined those schools to determine how many students would be affected.
Representative Saunders?
My question is maybe for you, Jason. If this was covered, I apologize that I didn't hear it, but how do we determine which accountability system is put in place if we're going to be looking at schools that aren't being graded or given a rating right now because they don't have that 30-student threshold? For those schools that will now be graded or given a rating, how do we determine which system is used?
The choice lies with the principal of the alternative school. And at an alternative school, which we are defining an ESC center as an alternative school, they can choose a rating or a grade. But a traditional public school, whether it be a traditional public school or a public charter school, they would be subject to school grades. And so currently there are, you know, as Jane mentioned, there are some schools that do not meet that cell size requirement, which is 30. And so what the bill does, it lowers it to 10, so it would increase the number of schools that would receive a school grade.
A school grade or a rating?
Well, currently, there's a dichotomy between a school grade and a rating. For a school grade, you must have 30, but for alternative schools, you only need 10. And I think the rationale behind that was because of the transient nature of those schools and the amount of data that you need. They would never meet that 30 threshold, so they lowered it to 10 to try to increase the accountability of those schools. But as you see, you know, you still have some slipping through the cracks.
Okay. So, I mean, I think when you look at this bill, and I think there's two components. I mean, the first component is really open access to data. I mean, one of the things we have here in Florida with our accountability system is a data-rich environment. If you can measure it, it's measured. What you do with that data being available gives you ample opportunity to look at different approaches, different programs, and see the efficacy of it. And I know Ms. Fletcher is she's kind of the data guru behind the scenes. And any question you can think of on how it affects performance, our department can get at. And the second, and I think Ms. Smith's testimony was very powerful, is this idea of, with these ESC centers, is a balance. You don't want these ESC centers to exist to enable, you know, some districts or some students to go into these centers, to get them off the grid and be disconnected from their home school, because if the ultimate goal is inclusion, you want that connection. You know, at the same time, you have that balance between, you know, homeschools being accountable and responsible for students that are in their school, and that's the balance you're trying to achieve. So, with that, I think we've accomplished a first for our committee, which is we are done in under 2 hours, and we're not racing to beat the clock, and nobody was rushed with questions. We're accomplishing a historical first for our committee, and it was ending with a dramatic flourish. But of course you can. But please fill out an appearance card after you speak. And members, no questions.
That's fine. I'm so apologize. My name is Wendy Dodge. I'm with Polk County Schools. I wasn't planning to testify today. However, Ms. Fletcher made a comment earlier that I thought needed to be explained. She said that we would not want to put pull low-performing students out of our schools and put them in alternative centers. However, that's what our alternative centers are. They're for low-performing students who aren't doing well, who aren't on track for graduation, or who are at risk of dropping out of school. So I just wanted to make sure that we clarify that when we put these students in these programs, this is a smaller, it's a better learning environment for them to hopefully get them on track, get them back into a larger program if it's possible, but get them on track for graduation. And then the additional requirement in the bill that says that you have to be in a campus, you have to be in a separate campus, is problematic for getting those students to want to be in those programs, because if I'm in a high school and now they say that I need to be in an alternative program, I don't want to leave my boyfriend and my siblings and sports programs at the school and stuff like that to go to a program somewhere else. I want to still be part of my school environment, but be in an alternative setting where I'm getting the programmatic and the academic support that I need. And so we think that it's not in the best interest of students to have this requirement for the separate campuses, and it's also not in the best interest of taxpayers. Why should I have to build a building across the street when there's space right here to serve these students? So that was our only concern, and we wanted to make sure we address the committee. Thank you. I did it really fast.
No, you're good. Thank you. Thanks so much. No, you're not allowed to question Representative Diaz. I was trying not to make eye contact either way, right or left. So, but go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It really, it's not going to be a question, just a comment I wanted to bring on the record. And I think we're all aware of the articles that came, and talking about accountability, that came out in the Miami Herald references supplemental educational services. And we got a statement from the commissioner. And I just wanted to go on the record and saying that I think that we need to work diligently with the commissioner to make sure that these tutoring opportunities remain for those low-income students. But at the same time, we need to require some more rigor and close all of the loopholes that would cause either any kind of fraud or having bad actors involved in this. So I think that whether we're addressing it or not in this accountability bill, we need to focus on working with the commissioner to make sure we close and address that, and just continue on, keep the good parts of it, and make sure that we eliminate all of the bad actors.
Thank you, Representative Diaz. I think you speak on behalf, however, read the articles and started to look at the issue. I think you spoke on behalf of all of us, and I couldn't agree with you more completely. So, with that, Representative Diaz moves. We rise. Yeah.